Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
I think they're quite good. There have been a lot of support. I've had endorsements from all the four regions of the party, regional committees and others, including the National Governing Council, which is the main body of the party. They've all endorsed me for nomination for the presidency and also for the election.
Former Malawian president seeks to compete in next year's general election.
A lot of reports have emerged in the public domain of continued violations of various human rights by the Zambia Police Service. And what we have done today is more or less a reaction to these public concerns, as well as the concerns we have as an institution that is receiving a lot of complaints based on the work of the police.
Zambia's Human Rights Commission expresses concern over recent reports of police officers violating the rights of citizens.
And a lot of sensitization was done, and people agreed to protect the girl child, having known the effects of FGM on the sexual and reproductive health rights of women and girls. So repealing that law means repealing all the rights that women have regarding their sexual and reproductive health.
And the Gambia's former vice president condemns a lawmaker's plan to reverse a 2015 ban on female genital mutilation. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Former Malawian President Arthur Peter Mutharika has declared plans to lead the main opposition Democratic Progressive Party, or DPP, as the presidential candidate in next year's general election. Party officials say he is likely to be confirmed in the group's coming Congress to choose representatives for the DPP. The former president has been meeting religious and traditional leaders and is garnering endorsements from some leaders of the party ahead of its convention in July. If confirmed by the DPP, the former president will challenge incumbent President Lazarus Chakwera. It will be a repeat of the last general election in which Chakwera, an opposition parliament member from the Tonse Alliance, was declared the winner. Former President Mutharika tells me that unkept promises of the Chakwera administration are the key reason Malawians want him back to rescue the country from the challenges facing them.
That's correct. I've said that I'll be running at the convention in July for nomination as a candidate for the Democratic Progressive Party.
What do you think your chances are, Mr. President, that the party will endorse you as the candidate?
I think they're quite good. There have been a lot of support. I've had endorsements from all the four regions of the party, regional committees and others, including the National Governing Council, which is the ruling body, the main body of the party. They've all endorsed me for nomination for the presidency and also for the election. So I think the chances are quite good.
But Mr. President, a lot of questions people are asking is, why do you even want to return to the presidency? Why do you even want to come back?
Well, I didn't want to, but as you know, there's been a lot of pressure in the country from all sectors of the from the party, from civil society, from chiefs. From chiefs and other sectors of the economy. The economy is completely destroyed, and absent human rights. In other words, the Malawi is moving towards a failed state, and therefore there are demands for me to come back, and I simply acceded to those demands.
Well, Mr. President, these were the same allegations made against you that your policies failed and plunged a lot of Malawians into poverty and penury. And that is why political analysts said you were rejected and defeated at the polls by the Tonse Alliance, led by now President Lazarus Chakwera, and that what you are coming to do is a repeat, and that Malawians have not forgotten the policies that you implemented that failed to meet their expectations.
That's quite correct. I did not lose the election. We lost the government, but not the election. As you know, we won in 2019, but the judiciary together with the opposition conspired and nullified the election, which had been declared by the European Union, the Commonwealth, African Union, SADC, COMESA, US government, UNDP, everyone as free, fair, and credible. And yet the court nullified it on the basis that there are irregularities, although admitted that there were some irregularities, but that those irregularities do not affect the outcome of the election. So they went ahead and nullified the election. Then they put conditions that instead of a majority, with a simple majority, it should now be 50 plus one. So they prepared the way when, in fact, the Tons Alliance and that was the My Congress Party and the UDM to win the election, it was all contrived. In fact, a senior member of the British Bar described the whole thing as a judicial coup d'etat, the first proper judicial coup d'etat in history. This is what happened. So my government never failed. We won the election in 2019, and we stabilized the economy. Inflation was down to 8%. Exchange rate was stable. We had import cover of more than 6 months. Today, the import cover of only 5 days, inflation at 37%, and cost of living has gone back up by almost 300%. So the government has completely failed. So you got to compare what happened in 2020 with what happened now. It's an entirely different situation.
Are there plans for you to form an alliance with any other opposition party? Because you fell out with then your vice president, who is the current vice president, who has also fallen out with the current president. Are you looking at forming an alliance?
No, we're not doing that at all. I think we can win on our own. We have so much support in the country that we do not need an alliance.
Arthur Peter Mutharika is Malawi's former president. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe. Zambia's Human Rights Commission is expressing concern over a recent report about police officers violating the rights of citizens, condemning what it says are arbitrary arrests, torture, and the detention of suspects. The Human Rights Commission called on authorities to warn police officers to stop acts of violence against citizens. The police deny the accusations as without merit. In a recently released statement, the chairperson of the Human Rights Commission, Pamela Towela Sambo, says the organization has called on the Inspector General of Police to take action to ensure his forces do not use excessive force in carrying out their duties. Chairperson Pamela Towela Sambo tells me that the organization has launched an investigation into allegations of torture, inhumane or degrading treatment, or extrajudicial punishment of suspects and other violations of human rights.
So the statement we have issued today is in relation to the police service, the Zambia Police Service, and how they are conducting their work. The background we have is we receive a lot of complaints, and we've previously been in communication with the Zambia Police Service in terms of how they carry out their work and how it affects the protection and promotion of human rights in the country. And the further background is that a lot of reports have emerged in the public domain of continued violations of various human rights by the Zambia Police Service. And what we have done today is more or less a reaction to these public concerns, as well as the concerns we have as an institution that is receiving a lot of complaints based on the work of the police. So that is the background against the statement that we issued today.
But Pamela, some people are expressing concern that your press release is not a true reflection of what is on the ground.
Well, in the audio that accompanied the statement, we just didn't give the detail, but we have over 90% of cases reported to the Human Rights Commission, the border on police brutality, extrajudicial killings, arbitrary arrests, torture, cruel and inhuman degrading punishment that the police met out in the process of making arrests and interrogations. So the evidence is there. And what we are seeing out there in the public domain, you look at social media, you look at the newspaper reports, the reports are there, they speak for themselves. What seems to be the truth is that 90% or over 90% actually of cases bordering on human rights abuse that the commission is investigating are centered on the police, and we have had this conversation with the police and the police public complaints authority.
What do you say to those who are saying that the Human Rights Commission should allow the police, mandated by the Constitution to maintain law and order, to do their job and not to interfere with what they are trying to do to keep the peace and to maintain law and order?
Wow. First and foremost, the Human Rights Commission will always interfere where we see human rights breaches. So I would not even term it interference. When you look at the constitutional provisions that create the Office of the Zambia Police Service as well as the Human Rights Commission, we share the mandate to uphold the Bill of Rights. So when we speak to the police and remind them about this role that we have together with them, we are not interfering. Our mandate in the Constitution is to ensure that we have protection and promotion of human rights throughout the country against any act that is taking place in the country. The police, yes, they must maintain law and order as well as uphold human rights. It is possible to police and have respect for human rights. That is all we are saying. And our concern is that the police need to have a delicate balance between maintaining law and order, preserving life and property, and the respect and dignity of the human person. That is all.
Major complaints, I understand, have come from the opposition and civil society groups, but are you engaging them as well as the police to try to find this delicate balance?
Yes, indeed. We have engaged the police primarily. We have been in talks with police, closed doors. We have shared a lot of the concerns they have. They also have huge operational problems, and we have related to these problems because they are also the problems of the commission. However, the promotion and preservation of human rights is non-negotiable. And because the police are being singled out, even in our own investigations, in our own analysis of the nature of the complaints we receive, it is the police that are topping. And remember, the Zambia Police Service affects the governance record of the country.
Pamela Towela Sambo is the chairperson of Zambia's Human Rights Commission. She spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. The Gambia's former vice president has condemned as unwelcome a plan by a lawmaker to reverse a 2015 ban on female genital mutilation, or FGM, in the West African nation. Issa Tuture is also head of the Gambia Committee on Traditional Practices Affecting the Health of Women and Children, known as GAMCOTROP. The organization campaigns against female genital mutilation and promote women's empowerment through education. Tuure rejects argument that the FGM is a religious practice, adding that tradition is dynamic and can be changed. Her remarks come after an independent member of parliament, Almame Giba, introduced a motion in the legislature seeking to overturn the law that banned female circumcision. Issa Tuture tells me that many Gambians are now more aware that female genital mutilation is harmful.
Alma, Honorable Diba trying to overturn the law that protects the rights of women and girls is unwelcomed by many people in the Gambia. But the fact that a lot of work has been done and a lot of sensitization was done and people agreed to protect the girl child, having known the effects of FGM on the sexual and reproductive health rights of women and girls. So repealing that law means repealing all the rights that women have regarding their sexual and reproductive health.
Now, according to her, this is an alien culture, a Western culture trying to be imposed on the people of the Gambia. That who are these people trying to tell the Gambians how to live their lives?
What? That is just an excuse to justify what he thinks is not right for, women. Nobody is trying to justify the fact that we are being westernized also. But we must also be ready to accept the fact that culture is not static, it's not a continuum, and that if we must be brave enough to deal with aspects of culture that we have found to be negative on women and girls. I think that is what he has to understand, because people who are fighting the FGM, that is Gamco Trap and many other rights activists, are Gambians, people who have been survivors of FGM, but have seen the negative effect on FGM on their sexuality, and also on women. I think it is a just cause for activists to engage.
About 180 civil society organizations have signed an open letter urging the Gambian government to uphold the anti-FGM law. However, the fear is that what Honorable Giba is doing, it might pass in the Gambian parliament. Is this a true reflection of, is the fear expressed by civil society groups, including yourself, justified?
Well, yes, you know what is happening. They are the lawmakers, and they have the opportunity to be in the house and represent their people. But what is happening right now in the communities, there is heightened knowledge that Gampo Trap has already generated over the years, for the past 30 years, including other organizations. And the law is there to protect the guy. What they are doing, they have right to discuss, but then they said it has been pushed to the committee for discussion. Now, we listen and wait for what the committee is going to say, because the justification that they have led, that they have laid down, such as religion and culture, religion, this has nothing to do with our religion. This predates religion, all monotheistic religions. It is a traditional practice that is long in existence before the advent of any religion in the world. So it has nothing to do with our political or with our religion. Culture more is changes and it's on a constant, it's not static, it's on a continuum. So all that I want to say is that we are waiting to see what they are going to do. I am disappointed though to hear that people using the argument to say, billahi wa lie tell lie, this is our religion and it's part of our culture. Nobody is not saying that it is not part of our culture, but culture changes. And what is happening is that people are changing with times, and culture is changing, and anything that is inimical to the health and well-being of women is wrong. So let's see what happens. They have the right to do whatever they want, but let them go to the public and see. We will see what happens next after this law is being repealed, because there is a lot of mobilization being done on both sides.
Giba, on the other hand, is arguing that the ban was not wanted by most people in the Gambia, which, of course, it's a predominantly Muslim country, but like he's arguing, they will not be dictated to by Western philosophy and their views on what we have to do. He was quoted as saying, how do you respond to that?
You see, anything that has to do with women's rights or women's sexuality, or any person who wants to bring in progress for women, there is resistance. Resistance trying to blame the West. Which country on earth has nothing to do with the West? All our development initiatives and everything we do, we derive some of our support and resources from the West. But when it comes to women's rights issues, now they say we are being influenced by the West. I have been target, my organization have been target, and few other women and men who are supporting women's rights are also a target, are considered target. So this is hypocrisy. I think what they are trying to do is just to silence us and to make sure that the West will not give us support if we need it to be able to move this further, forgetting that the Gambia is not an island. It's part of the community of nations. that have already signed the conventions, all the international conventions, regional conventions, and even to our National Assembly, where our constitution, that protects and promotes its rights. So Gambia is under obligation to ensure that those rights are put forth and they are respected and recognized and protected.
Aissa Touré is the Gambia's former vice president. She spoke with me from the Gambian capital, Banjul. The Director General of Liberia's Civil Service Agency says he is implementing measures to combat mismanagement, fraud, and waste. At a news conference, Josiah Jokai said he is just implementing recommendations contained in the report of the Auditor General, which spanned 2018 to 2021. The report, local media say, uncovered mismanagement, fraud, and waste. The move follows Jokai's launch of a payroll cleanup campaign after the government expressed concern about what some officials say appears to be a bloated payment system. He tells me that as part of the measures to ensure transparency and accountability, the Civil Service Agency is placing a moratorium on the salaries of over 100 public sector workers who Jokai says had illegal bank accounts, which cost the government about $31,000 a month.
So the Civil Service Agency just decided to take these major actions yesterday to ensure the implementation of the audit recommendations. And among them, you have certain recommendations that are to be implemented through a multi-sectoral approach. Those ones, we did not touch them yesterday. We will be meeting with the Ministry of Finance and other agencies concerned. But there are those that are simple and straightforward that required the action of the Civil Service Agency.
Let's look at your agency. What are the three major issues you want to tackle per the report of the Attorney General?
The Attorney General's finding show that 9,287 individuals were unverified as employees during the audit. And the Auditor General recommended that a moratorium should be placed on those on salary payments to those individuals pending a 90-day verification process. Peter, that was in 2021. Those individuals did not turn out for verification. And 2 years later, they did not also turn out for verification. Those individuals constitute 13.7%. of the workforce, and the government is losing $3.7 million to those individuals, those unverified individuals, potential ghosts on the payroll, $3.7 million every month. So yesterday, the Civil Service Agency took a major decision to block the salary payments to the 9,287 individuals for the month of April. Pending 1 month verification exercise, they have the opportunity to still come after 2 years to still come and be verified. Otherwise, as of the month of May, the Civil Service Agency is going to permanently remove the 9,287 individuals from the payroll, and we will be saving $3.7 million. The other set of fictitious individuals that that the audit identified on the payroll are 166 individuals who have shared bank account numbers. So what does that mean? So you have about 10 persons, for example, on the same payroll, but with one single bank account number, meaning the salaries of those 10 individuals are going to one bank account number. So also in 2021, the Auditor General recommended that a moratorium should be placed on salary payments to those individuals pending investigation. Those individuals are still on the payroll. They are receiving pay. And so the Civil Service Agency yesterday took similar action to ensure that the salary payments to those individuals are blocked for the month of April and pending investigation.
So with all these inconsistencies or troubling findings contained in the Attorney General's report you talked about, Are there going to be investigations from your organization to ascertain what is going on and possibly for remedial measures to be taken?
That is correct. I mentioned that very strongly in my press conference yesterday, that we are not only interested in identifying the individuals concerned. If these individuals don't come over to be verified, we will permanently remove them from the payroll as of May, but we will also forward the names of individuals responsible for instituting these discrepancies to the Ministry of Justice for prosecution. The government has lost so much money, millions, to these unscrupulous individuals. Since 2018, the audit was conducted, and to cover the period 2018 to 2021, these unscrupulous accounts on the payroll have been receiving salary payments in millions every month. So this is concerning. The Liberian people are seriously concerned about this. The support, overwhelmingly, the actions of the civil service agency to address the payroll problem, to solve some of the financial constraints on the government. We have to make sure that we have savings from these unscrupulous behaviors and move those savings to human security-related sectors like education, healthcare, national security, so that we can improve the lives of our people.
Josiah Jokai is the Director General of Liberia's Civil Service Agency. He spoke with me from the Liberian capital, Monrovia. The Kenya Union of Post-Primary Education Teachers, known as KUPET, is calling on members of parliament to do more to address the needs of the union's members. This after the union said the legislature was avoiding discussing issues that affect public sector workers. But a lawmaker dismissed the accusation, saying KUPET is to blame for the difficulties its members face. Parliament member Opiyo Wandayi says workers' unions are failing to address most of the issues concerning the rank and file. Akello Mizori is the Secretary General of the Kenyan Union of Post-Primary Education Teachers. He tells me the National Assembly appears to be broken and disinterested in finding solutions to challenges facing public workers.
First, the Kenyan Parliament is dysfunctional with regard to the sensitive nature of the Kenyan budget. The Kenyan budget is going to about 4 trillion. And basing on this kind of budget, the education sector is the key because it's the main driver of all the aspects of the economy. And now when teachers are complaining about promotions, then the Kenyan parliamentarians are saying that the teachers have not provided sufficient evidence of how the promotions were done. And the money which was given to promote the teachers was less than even what could promote a part of the teachers who qualified to be promoted, leaving the service to be demotivated. Lack of motivation make even the quality of education to be compromised. That is one. The Kenyan Parliament has not even taken 5 minutes to discuss the plight of doctors who are already on strike now for going to about 1 month. That is very unfortunate. So when we look at the way the Constitution of Kenya regards the appropriation of Kenyan budget, it is Parliament to allocate, appropriate, and ensure that this money is delivered to all the sectors of the economy. The Parliament, as we have today, is being controlled by the executive.
Some of your critics are saying, if this is what parliamentarians need, they need evidence to meet your needs and demands. Why don't you provide the evidence and the study to back
our up evidence? Our evidence is basically to be used as a strategy to engage the employer for the social dialogue platform, which is established by the ILO. And within our laws, the Parliament has got a Department of Research. They are representatives of the people, and they have the people's concerns, and the people are complaining everywhere. They should use that. But now when we told them that the Teacher Service Commission was supposed to promote teachers who have stagnated in the service for more than 10 years and beyond, then that is something which, as whistleblowers of the union, we were not supposed to be put to task to give Parliament that. They were supposed to use their own systems to establish the fact.
So, Mr. Missouri, your critics are saying CUPET is to blame, your organization is to blame for failing your members to continue to manage your affairs effectively, which they said is creating problems for your members, which you are blaming, they said, on Parliament.
That is far from the truth, because when we raised the idea, we already conducted a survey early in the year, and we raised the issue that Kenyan teachers stagnate in the various job groups for far much too longer periods than required by law. This one was contained in a report which we shared with the employer. Now, the members of Parliament continue to invite unions to sit in the committees and subject them to embarrassment, as if they don't know that it is Treasury which releases the money, and therefore they should as well ask the Ministry of Education, why are you sitting on disbursement of funds which are required first to promote teachers, secondly to manage schools?
You made the statement that MPs have not prioritized discussion on issues that will benefit teachers. However, a member of Parliament, Mr. Oganja, spoke that workers' woes are because their unions fail to take care of their interests. What say you?
The MP for Ugunja failed to address the key issues. He only wanted to over-sensationalize the issue of the plight, because he sees an opportunity of our presence in a meeting where he was, basically to look for what could make him to sound very relevant. So in that regard, we did realize that it was not a point for us to address him then.
Akello Missouri is the Secretary General of the Kenyan Union of Post-Primary Education Teachers. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, in Uganda, the former leader of the opposition in parliament has dismissed his suspension as deputy president of the National Unity Platform, or NUP. Mathias Mpuuga says the leader of the NUP, Robert Kyagulanyi, also known as Bobi Wine, does not have any constitutional or legal right to suspend him. It comes after Mpuuga refused to resign as a parliamentary commissioner of the NUP over allegations of corruption. Some political analysts say the friction within the NUP could derail its electoral prospect ahead of the next general election. But Goluba Mutebi, an independent political analyst and researcher, tells me he is not surprised about the friction within the NUP, but is not convinced it will affect its future electoral prospects.
All political parties in Uganda do break up into factions every now and then. And as we speak, I think that only the ruling party, the National Resistance Movement, is the one that doesn't have factions or hasn't broken out into active internal conflict. And there is a sense in which one could say that this stems from the way multi-party politics was restored in 2005. Because largely, in addition to internal pressure agitating for multi-party democracy, a great deal more pressure came from outside. And from inside the country, the president and a good number of people within his party did not want to return the country to multi-party politics. But once that happened, the strategy for the ruling party to manage its hold on power and keep everyone out was partly to ensure to cause divisions within political parties.
Some analysts are also saying that aren't the opposition parties to blame themselves, especially when they are allowing themselves or supposedly to be manipulated by external pressures or external influences?
One has to contextualize what has happened. When President Museveni came to power in 1986, he suspended multi-party politics, and for 20 years, Uganda was a so-called no-party democracy. What that did was to weaken all the pre-existing parties because they were frozen in place. They couldn't replace their leaders. They couldn't choose new leaders. They couldn't engage in activities that help political parties to grow. So there was a complete atrophy of the old parties. Now, when the new parties emerged, they emerged in a context where Ugandans for 20 years had got used to what we call personal merit or individual merit in Uganda, whereby you elect people based on your evaluation of those individuals as individuals, not as members of political organizations.
People are expressing concern about the lack of unity with the NUP. There seem to be too many divisions, which will undermine, they argue, the party's electoral prospect, with very little or no structures in place that will ensure the party's appeal to the nation as a whole, because as it stands now, it only performs best in the central region of Uganda.
I think that's a bit of an exaggeration. The divisions within NUP are not as widespread or as deep as some people portray them. Because as we stand now, the person who is really in the limelight as being at the center of these divisions is Mr. Mpuga. And Mr. Mpuga has come into conflict with the party over an amount of money that was awarded to him in parliament, allegedly illegally, and which the party had required him to return, and also to explain, which he did not. So this one individual, I really personally doubt that he can have the kind of impact that people are predicting. Even within his own constituency, the branch of NUP there is also divided. They are not coherently behind him. But behind him, it is my understanding that a greater majority are behind the party president, Bobi Wine. But also, we shouldn't forget that NUP won very heavily in the central region without having structures on the ground. What drove NUP's good performance in the central region, which is the most urbanized region, was the very widespread disaffection with the ruling party. And I'm not sure that this has changed. Now, it wasn't able to win outside the central region for all kinds of reasons, partly because Bobi Wine was not allowed to go around campaigning freely.
Thank you.
Goloba Mutebi is an independent political analyst and researcher. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. '91-year-old Cameroonian President Paul Biya will be a candidate in the 2025 presidential elections, aiming to extend his more than four-decade rule. Supporters say Biya is the only one who can bring peace and development to the country, but the opposition says Biya must leave office after running Cameroon for four decades. For VOA Moki, Edwin Kenzeka reports from the capital, Yaoundé.
Several hundred people sang in Cameroon's capital Yaoundé on Sunday that President Paul Biya should accept the nomination for the Cameroon People's Democratic Movement or CPDM party in the 2025 presidential election. Biya created the CPDM on March 24, 1985, 3 years after his predecessor, Cameroon's first president, Amadou Ahidjo, stepped down due to ill health and handed power to Biya. Biya has been president of Cameroon since 1982 and leader of his CPDM party since 1985. Senior CPDM official Fru Jonathan says during his party's 39th anniversary on Sunday, party officials organized rallies in all Cameroon towns and villages to ask civilians to support Biya as their candidate in the 2025 elections.
He is our natural candidate. He is strong, healthy. Government activity is going on normally. There's peace, there's unity in our country. There's economic growth. We think that you don't change your winning team. If there's any challenger, let him come over. We've not seen any challenger who can beat our candidate. So we all rely on him and call on him to continue to rule and bring our country to emergence, as that is his vision.
Biya has not said if he will be a candidate. Fru said Biya, in 41 years of leadership, has increased the number of state-owned universities from 1 to 11. Cameroon senior state functionaries appointed by Biya, along with Biya's party officials, credit the long-serving leader for constructing at least 6,000 kilometers of roads, providing electricity and water to towns and villages, and building several hundred classrooms and hospitals. But Cameroon's opposition and civil society disagree with that positive assessment, saying under Biya, the Cameroon Bank and the Fund for Agricultural Development created to fund farmers' projects crumbled. The opposition also says corruption has become widespread during Biya's rule, with Transparency International ranking Cameroon as the most corrupt country in 1998 and 1999. 44-year-old Cabral Libi, an opposition parliamentarian with Cameroon's Party for National Reconciliation, or PCRN, placed third in Cameroon's 2018 presidential elections.
Être jeune au Cameroun aujourd'hui, c'est être privé de voix, de choix.
Libi says Cameroonian youth will not continue to watch Biya cripple the economy, deprive civilians of their liberties and freedoms, and rule Cameroon with an iron fist while now showing signs of being ruler for life. He says Biya is the cause of sorrows brought about by extremely high unemployment, underemployment, and crisis in the English-speaking Western regions that have claimed more than 6,000 lives. Libi said Cameroon opposition and civil society are organizing themselves to present a candidate to oust Biya, whom they describe as elderly and frail, to the point he is hardly seen in public. Libi said Cameroon needs young, dynamic leaders to salvage the country from underdevelopment. Opposition and civil society say many youths were hired to take part in rallies to give the false impression that Biya is popular. Both the government and Biya's CPDM party officials deny that civilians, especially poor youths, were hired. At 91, Biya is the oldest leader in the world and the second longest-serving president after his neighbor Teodoro Obiang-Gema Bassongo of Equatorial Guinea. Biya's party says he has won all presidential elections since the return of multi-party politics in Cameroon in 1990, but the opposition says previous elections have been marred by fraud. Malki Edwin Kinzuka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
G7 nations and the European Union have a new diamond tracking system that requires all gems entering their markets to be routed through Belgium to catch sanctioned Russian diamonds. African diamond-producing countries have raised objections to the system, saying it adds to their costs and disrupts the supply chain. Belgium and the EU say steps are being taken to minimize delays. For viewing, Kodisi Dube reports from Africa's biggest diamond exporter, Botswana.
African producers led by Botswana are demanding a review of the tracking and verification system introduced by EU and G7 nations on March 1. Under the arrangement, diamonds entering EU and G7 countries have to be sent to Antwerp for certification in an effort to prevent the importation of Russian diamonds. EU and G7 nations represent 70% of the global diamond market. The traceability initiative has resulted in clearance delays and disruption to the supply chain. African diamond producers argue that has resulted in added costs. Botswana's President Mokgweetsi Masisi recently said the EU and G7 countries had not officially responded to a letter from African producers on concerns over the new tracking system. On Thursday, Masisi told France's Minister of State for Development and International Partnerships, Kreisler, Zakharopoulou, that G7 countries should reconsider the traceability initiative.
That would be a regression in terms of our own development and an ominous threat to our existence and everything that we base our growth on. We just think because they did not engage sufficiently, they haven't come to appreciate what the threats are to industry and to livelihoods and economies.
But a Belgian official told VOA the turnaround time for the certifications has improved with all shipments processed within 24 hours. The official, speaking on condition of anonymity, says delays were due to importers not providing the necessary documentary evidence. He said African countries are bearing no increase in production cost because expenses are borne by the mining companies. An EU official responding to VOA inquiries says African producers' concerns were considered from the onset. She says meetings were held among the EU bloc's representatives, the US and the Botswana government. The EU representative says the response has been delayed because it is being drawn up as a collective G7 reply. Botswana is the world's second largest producer of diamonds after Russia. Its diamond exports last year were worth $7 billion. Kondisi Dube for VOA News, Gaborone, Botswana.
And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Ha! Ha! No man.
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Douglas Mpuga and engineer Tiang Wang, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, ants die in sugar. I'm your host, Peter Clote in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Yeah.